The Consequences of an Idea. Now, on A View from the Bunker. Imagine you awaken as if from a dream and find yourself tied in a chair in a very dark room. Into your field of vision walks a man, well-dressed, speaking with a very educated tone, and he informs you that unless you give him a very good reason not to kill you, he will do so. This is the premise of a very thought-provoking short film called Cruel Logic by our guest tonight. He is an author, a screenwriter, a director. He's written scripts for such films as To End All Wars with Kiefer Sutherland and Robert Carlyle, the film adaptation of Frank Peretti's novel The Visitation, and a forthcoming movie about the Scopes Monkey Trial that's due out later this year called Alleged, which stars Brian Dennehy, Fred Thompson, and Cal Meany of Star Trek fame. He's also written books on watching media with a discerning eye, Hollywood worldviews, watching films with wisdom and discernment, and word pictures, knowing God through story and imagination. It's our honor to welcome to the program Brian Gadawa. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Derek.
It is an interesting bit of film, the 6 or 7 minutes of Cruel Logic. The victim, a college professor, finds himself in quite a predicament. What role does his worldview play in landing him in that in dire straits?
Yeah. Well, first of all, just to let people know too that they can go check out Cruel Logic on YouTube. Just type in Cruel Logic, or to go to my website gadawa.com, which has a better higher quality QuickTime that you can watch for it. But yeah, the genesis of that worldview thinking—it really did come from worldview thinking. I for many years, I've kind of been interested in apologetics and philosophy, and in particular, and for many years, I have in some way I've been frustrated as I speak to people, particularly atheists or people who don't believe in God. You know, they'll have their arguments and stuff, but so often I find that people do not think through the ramifications of their beliefs. They just say these things like, oh, morality is relative, so stop pushing your Christianity on people. You can't say something's wrong. And I mean, so many people have said things that just frustrate me, because they're like, don't you realize what you're saying? That if what you're saying is true, you know, you've just allowed everyone to murder people because you're imposing your belief on others to say murder's wrong. You know, things like that. I've just struggled with how thoughtless many people are. They just don't think through their ideas. And one of the things that has struck me personally was this notion that ideas have consequences.
Hmm.
Ideas have consequences. Another thing is not only do they not think through the ramifications, but it's like they don't live consistently with their beliefs. C.S. Lewis wrote about this, where, you know, in Mere Christianity, when he would talk about, oh, it's all very well and good when someone says, that morality is relative and you shouldn't push yours on others. But as soon as they're in the bus and someone cuts in front of them in line, they'll certainly say, hey, now what's all this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea there is that people do not live consistently. They speak things in order to justify themselves, but they don't live consistently with them. So Cruel Logic kind of came from that frustration where I wanted to kind of like make kind of like a slap on the cheek, you know, like when someone's like, you know, when someone is half conscious, you know, you got to wake them up, you know. I wanted to be a slap on the cheek, and what could be a great way to express that? And what happened was, many years ago, I had actually heard Walter Martin, famous old evangelist from, you know, a long, long time ago.
The Bible Answer, the original Bible Answer Man.
Yeah, the original Bible Answer Man, yeah. Now,
right.
So I heard this long John Neville show from the 60s, and he's debating this atheist about morality, and he's getting all frustrated because the atheist is saying all these moral relative claims and all this stuff, and Walter finally stops. He says, okay, look, he goes, it's 1945, Nazi Germany, I'm a Nazi and I have a Luger pointed right at you right now. And he says, and you're a Jew, give me one reason why I shouldn't kill you. He's trying to make this point that you're as an atheist, you're taking away all morality by saying it's relative or, you know, whatever, and that if you really did that, then you just killed yourself, sort of thing. And that always stuck with me. And after watching the movie Seven, I got inspired to kind of put those two together, and I came up with this idea called Logic. And it's actually a feature film. I wrote it as a feature film, and I'm still trying to actually get funding for the movie, the feature. But what I did was I thought one of the ways that could help sell the idea, and at the same time sort of get, maybe if I could get it out on the internet, you know, these days it might draw some attention, is to make a short. So I took, you know, the premise of it is this philosopher serial killer is capturing university professors. And he's debating them on tape, on videotape, tying them up and debating them. And the topic of the debate is his moral right to kill them. Give me one reason why I shouldn't kill you and I'll let you go, if what you say is true about the universe is true. And there's a cop and a psychiatrist who are trying to track him down. And so it's this cat and mouse game. And he's sending them these videotapes as he's debating and all that. And the debate, there's something bigger going on here than just that debate. But the idea was that if I could take one of the scenes of the debates in the movie and extend it out, sort of make it a little, you know, more full, so it could be its own little piece, and then I could sort of picture that for people so they could see what a feature might look like, and it might help me to sell the idea, you know. And so I made the short and got Tony Hale from Arrested Development and, you know, and another unknown actor, Robert Pierce, to play this scene, and it took a day to shoot it, a complete day. I mean, you know, we had a professional crew and everything, and took a complete day to shoot it. But yeah, that's kind of the genesis of it, and the idea there was that the scene that you'll see is one long complete debate, which is like 7 minutes, and it's not that long in the movie, but that's how it is in the short.
Yeah, very thought provoking.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of how it came together.
The final shot before you fade to the credits is is quite disturbing, where he flicks on the propane torch.
but make sure everyone knows there's no blood and gore.
Right.
It's all tension and scary buildup. It's not about gory things. It's just about the terror of evil, not the physical side of it.
The way Hitchcock would present it, instead of actually showing it, it's the tension leading up to it. To use an old metaphor, it's so thick you could cut it with a knife.
Yeah, and it's about suspense, not about gore. So
right.
Don't worry, it's not rated R in that sense. But it, you know, hopefully it's scary to people. And my point, my goal there is that I think, if I can go off on another little tangent, I think it's very connected to this. I'm kind of the apologist for horror. I've also written an article on horror films, actually. You can find it on my website, ikadawa.com. But it also was in the Christian Research Journal, which is an apologetics journal. And the idea there is that horror is actually a very biblical, powerful genre of storytelling to communicate deep spiritual truths to people. In other words, the essence of it is, if you want to communicate how spiritually serious something is, how it can affect you, or how evil it is, or the potential of it, horror is a genre that does that. So, for instance, in the Bible, God, like, for example, in Ezekiel, God wanted to, let's just go right to Revelation. You know, Book of Revelation, the entire thing, no matter what, you know, eschatological view you believe, you still believe that, you know, Revelation is full of symbols. And you've got these huge monstrous beasts eating people and destroying cities and all this kind of stuff. And you've got, you know, just all kinds of bizarre creatures and killing people, et cetera. But the point of that is not only is God sort of apocalyptically talking about what's going to happen in the future from, you know, at the time when they were writing that, but I think there's another side of it is God is showing the spiritual reality behind the events. You know, there are other passages when Israel was falling away in the Old Testament, you know, Israel would constantly fall away and worship the Baals, worship the foreign gods, right? And when that would happen, God would chastise them, and he would send his prophets, for example, and they would say things forgive me, I can't remember where this one is. I think it's also in Ezekiel, but he talks about how, you know, you are like, essentially zombies. I'm going to cause you to eat the flesh of your own because you are so spiritually depraved. He speaks about you know, Israel is like a prostitute or a whore that is just, you know, literally going and having sex with everyone that goes by, and describes these grotesque acts of sexuality to describe how serious their apostasy was. So, you know, in fact, the Bible has examples. I have it in my article. There's examples of drinking blood. There's vampire and werewolf examples in the Bible.
Yeah.
King Nebuchadnezzar was made into a werewolf, okay? So the idea here is that horror becomes a means for showing the spiritual seriousness, and that's what I want to do is, I want, in Cruel Logic, I wanted to say, these beliefs that you have are so serious that I want to force you, who have these beliefs, like, you know, the example in there would be a sociobiologist who believes all of our behavior is determined by genetics, you know. And I want to say, look, not only will you be willing to die for that belief, but look at what your belief leads to. Tell me I'm wrong. If what you say is true, that everything's reducible to genetics, then my violent behavior of murder is reducible to my genetics, which means there's no morality that says I shouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the only way you can really bring to life, not the only way, but the best way I think that you can bring to life a philosophical or apologetic argument is to embody it in a story. Storytelling puts flesh on what would otherwise be an abstract argument that can sometimes people can just evade. But when you show it to them in a story and embody it in characters, it's powerful. And that's what I hope Cruel Logic does, and I've heard that a lot of people have used it in that manner.
Yeah, some people would call such a method the telling of parables. Yeah, there's a long and honored history there. We're talking to Brian Godawa, author, screenwriter, director. His website is godawa.com, G-O-D-A-W-A.com, on A View from the Bunker. Now, you mentioned horror as a genre that is particularly useful in conveying spiritual truths.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, as we watch film, and Sharon and I both are fans of the horror and suspense genres. And it's interesting you mentioned the movie Seven, by the way, because that was on AMC tonight. and it occurred to me to ask you if Seven had any influence on Cruel Logic. You've already answered that question. But very often what we'll see in the works of, say, Stephen King are his attempts to convey some spiritual truths or spiritual ideas in his horror films, films or books, novels like The Stand, for example. But he takes a very dark view of God. God almost as just sort of a cosmic chess player with no regard for humanity, as mere pawns on his chessboard in his great game with Satan. We don't see, at least I haven't noticed, and, you know, that horror is often used by Christian storytellers. Am I correct in that assumption? And if so, why is that?
Well, I think that's a very good question. There's several issues there at play. I do think that there's an increasing number, as more and more Christians are seeing the value of the media and of storytelling and of Hollywood movies. They're becoming less judgmental and less isolationist. I think they're starting to realize the value of these things. But I think that the primary thing I think that Christians react to with which, by the way, I want to you know, mention one of my heroes in that sense is Scott Derrickson, who is he's a Christian director and writer in Hollywood. He made the movie The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Okay.
And he's done. He also did The Day the Earth Stood Still. So he's a big Hollywood director. He's a Christian, and he loves see the value of horror. I think he's probably the first one to really get out there and do that in the mainstream Hollywood world. And now he's working on. He's actually developing the movie Goliath, which I've read, and I'll mention a little bit about that later as we talk about Nephilim and stuff. But you know, he is kind of like my hero because he's really doing it. And but in terms of how Christians react, Christians often react negatively immediately to horror because, of course, and understandably so, because a lot of times you mention that word, and what do you think of? You think of scantily clad co-eds, you know, being ripped apart by a guy with a knife, or, you know, gory, evil stuff. You know, you think of disgusting monsters murdering and carving up people in ever innovative and disgusting new ways, things like that, you know. And there's plenty of that out there, and I wouldn't necessarily support it. But the genre in and of itself, so Christians, that's what they think of, and they, you know, the those who critique horror basically see it as a sort of a genre that inspires fear. And fear, of course, is not of God, right? And I understand where they're coming from, and to a certain degree, I can agree with them. Fear can be a non-biblical thing; it can be a bad thing. And you know, as well as the violence and the sexuality that is often in there. But if we step back and say, okay, apart from some of the excesses of violence and sexuality, which is a separate issue, Christians often have problems with that. The notion of this fear, the engendering of fear. Yeah, there can be bad fear, but there can be good fear. For instance, if you were swimming in the ocean, and I saw a shark coming at you, I would hope that you would see fear as being a good thing for me to tell you to get out of the water. You're going to get chomped by a shark, right? And so fear, if it's used appropriately, and then, of course, fear, if it's used appropriately, it will produce righteousness or goodness of some kind. And there's plenty of that in the Bible. And that,
fear
like
of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, yeah.
Absolutely. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that fear does involve this notion of actions have consequences, behavior has consequences, you know. The Bible is full of God saying, you know, especially the Old Testament, you know, if you obey me, you know, to Israel, if you obey me, I will bless the land, etc. But if you do not, I will bring all these curses upon you. And the notion here is that, look, you know, if you live life the way you were created to, you know, you're going to have things are going to tend to work out. But if you do the wrong things, it's going to create this these consequences that will hurt you and others. And chastisement, that warning, is the thing that helps to keep us in line. So that's all over the Bible. So really, if horror is used in that sense, it can be entirely appropriate. Let me give you a classic example. This would be the movie Paranormal Activity and its sequel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Big, huge monster hit, man. I mean, the movie was like made for $15,000, and it's probably the highest grossing movie as a percentage of budget as any movie in history. Made over $110 million, I think, right? Paranormal Activity is a story about this couple who thinks their house is haunted, and so they put video camera up to show to videotape them at night so they can see if there's any ghosts or whatever. Well, they soon find out that they are being haunted, but it's actually probably a demon. But they're not believers. They're not Christians. So, you know, to them it's sort of like a demon, a spirit, evil spirit, whatever. We can fight this thing. Yeah, we'll fight it, you know, once they get to that point where they see it's real. Well, you know, of course, what happens is that, you know, midway through the film, they show this woman has become so scared she's clinging onto this crucifix that was, you know, that she had because she's fearful. She doesn't know what to do, and her hands are bleeding. She's holding it so tight, and her boyfriend takes it away from her and says, "You know, come on, this is crazy. We can fight this thing." And he takes the cross and he throws it in the fire. You know, and the symbol there is, of course, they don't go to Christ for their strength to fight this evil, and because of it, they end up losing. Now, that movie, in my opinion, is a very biblical war. I don't care whether or not they're Christians in it who made that movie. It doesn't matter. The movie itself, what it is incarnating, is a Christian message of warning that there's real spiritual evil in this world. And in today's world, many people don't even believe in demons, right? But this movie shows you that there are demons, and you cannot win against them without the power of Christ. And so that is a powerful, good biblical message. Now, I would say, okay, on the counter side, you could, you know, you might be able to make some arguments like, you know, maybe Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I don't watch a lot of the exploitative horror.
Right.
I'm not as interested in that. I like movies like Seven, movies that have a real deep moral message. But in general, horror has a moral essence to it because if you look at the history of it, you'll find that a lot of the modern-day horror comes from Victorian horror. You know, Frankenstein, Dracula. Mm-hmm. These were stories that were specifically showing man's hubris. So, for instance, Frankenstein is man's hubris of science, where he thinks he can become like God and control life and create life. Well, what happens? It comes back and bites him, doesn't it? Which is really what happens in a lot of sci-fi movies like Jurassic Park, where the dinosaurs come back and bite them in the butt because they did the part.
Right.
They did what could be done rather than questioning whether or not it should be done. And that
right.
was in the movie too. And all of Michael Crichton's novels are like that, and his movies are too. So this idea is that this horror shows us what the negative, and a lot of horror is based on science, but then the supernatural is not, and it's still based on man's hubris. Man's hubris of thinking he can, you know, fight this stuff alone, do it on his own, when that's the thing that gets him into the problem in the first place. So, you know, a couple of my favorite movies are zombie movies. I used to hate zombie movies because they were just a bunch of gory stuff.
Right.
But when 28 Days Later came out, and then 28 Weeks Later, the sequel, I thought there was a powerful moral message in that that showed it was a metaphor. And by the way, I Am Legend with Will Smith is a mainstream version of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Those were zombies in that movie. And the idea is this is a metaphor for what society becomes when it's without restraint, whether it's morals or whatever. And so 28 Days Later, you know, these guys are running from the zombies. Everyone's been contagious and all this, and they find this group of soldiers in the woods protecting themselves from the zombies. And they soon start to realize inside that bunker that these men are really no different than the zombies in a sense. They are as wicked to each other as the zombies are. They're, you know. And so there's this real strong metaphor of this need to understand our humanity, and we're losing our humanity by the various things in our society, whether it's consumerism, whether it's, you know, warmongering, whatever you can name it. And I think that's what those movies sort of brought back. And this notion of survival of the fittest. You know, 28 Weeks Later, it's all about do you seek to survive for yourself, or do you sacrifice yourself for others? And the people in that movie who protected themselves would all die, but the people who sacrificed themselves for others either, you know, helped others and died or lived. And so it's this notion of do we allow society to follow the evolutionary laws of survival of the fittest, or do we follow a higher law of sacrifice? You know, so these are some of the things I think are the advantages of horror and what make it a very biblical, potentially biblical genre. It doesn't mean it's all good. I don't think it's all good, but it makes it an
right.
acceptable genre.
Yes, some of it, as you mentioned, is exploitative, what we call torture porn. You know,
yeah.
just watching.
Yeah, like Hostel, things like that are just.
Right.
And although I have to admit, even Hostel has there's a slight moral message to it, but I would argue that it goes over the top and it becomes grotesque, and it's a celebration of evil. An entertainment of evil rather than the deeper moral message that's rooted within it. So you got to be careful there, yeah.
Well, now, as a guy working in Hollywood trying to work and earn his bread by appealing to enough of the public to make a living, how difficult is it to get a biblical message out there through the system?
Well, you know, there's a couple aspects to that. Number one, there's the Christian film market, which has become a burgeoning market thanks to movies. Well, you know, The Passion is the one that paved the way, but of course that was very unique, and, you know, you're not going to get anything like that. But it did open their eyes a little bit, and then along came Fireproof and Facing the Giants, and, you know, they made, you know, whatever, 40, 50 million Fireproof, which made studios wake up and say, hey, we can make money on this. And, I mean, there is a lot of agenda in Hollywood that is anti-Christ, and there is a lot of that, but it's not monolithic. There are also a lot of people who just want to make money, and if they see, oh, there's a niche market here for Christians, and they go out and they see because it makes a lot of money, and they'll want to make money too, and they'll find out what does the Christian genre have, and they want to make movies like that. So thus, this, you know, right now there's a movie out called Soul Surfer, which is a
right.
Christian movie released by Sony. So they are open to some of that. And there are strongly Christian elements in that. But I'm not in that camp. I don't do those kinds of movies per se. I'm more in embedding my worldview, kind of like Tolkien or C.S. Lewis would, which means, you know, our goal is to tell a great story. And because we are immersed in understanding that everybody has a worldview. Everyone operates from a worldview. A worldview is, you know, is embedded in all storytelling. Once you're intelligently aware of that, as you craft your stories, as you tell them. I'm not saying you sit there and you create propaganda or you try to deliberately twist things, but it certainly guides your choices and guides your storytelling. And so you the goal is you incarnate your worldview within the story. So what I mean is you don't necessarily have to have, you know, I think many Christians are kind of ignorant in this realm. They think that you got to have the John 3:16 Bible verse up there or people aren't going to get saved or something like that. And they see the purpose of art or movies as being, you know, tracts, you know, like Bible tracts or something.
Mm-hmm.
So they get disappointed when they don't have things spelled out loudly and clearly. But I think that's part of their modernist prejudice that we've all kind of grown up with. Because some of the greatest works of art that are full of Christianity are not necessarily, don't have the three spiritual laws in them, you know what I mean? So for example, you know, what I would argue would be a movie like Paranormal Activity is part of the, you could call it the pre-gospel, you know, where it's sort of opening people up to think about things that will make them see their need for God. Or maybe you might go deeper and communicate a more clear message, you know, like we did with To End All Wars, my prisoner of war story, which it wasn't a Christian movie like that genre I was speaking about, but it had a strong Christian worldview, and it kind of like Chariots of Fire or The Mission, you know. And it was, you know, prisoners of war suffering under the Japanese in World War II, starred Kiefer Sutherland, and it was a true story based on how these men dealt with the suffering. It's kind of like Schindler's List, only for the Allied soldiers. And, you know, it showed them dealing with the suffering and the torture, and basically, you know, one of the things that happened was they got a Bible in the camp and they started teaching out of the Bible. They would also teach Shakespeare and Plato as well. They started a jungle university, and one of the books was the Bible, and it just started to affect them and change the way they were treating one another. So they begin the camp trying to survive on their own, survive of the fittest, every man for himself. But as they start to apply this stuff that they're learning in their jungle university, they start to learn to love one another, and then by the end of the movie, they're faced with what does it mean to love your enemy, and that's an even harder thing. And
yeah,
you know, like I said, it's not, you know, it's not a Christian movie, but it embodies this notion of a worldview of faith and of Christianity that is lived out. And so there's lots of other stuff related to that, but I guess what I'm making a distinction here is a lot of evangelical Christians tend to misunderstand, and they think that art is supposed to preach a message. They think a movie is a sermon as a story, and that's not what it is. Now, a movie or a story can, like you mentioned, the parables, they can embody the message. That's what they do. But, and your various characters in your story may represent or have worldviews that you are addressing, just like Jesus, just like Nathan told his parable to David. The characters might represent, you know, like remember Jesus' parable with the soils, and each soil represented a different person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it, though. At the time he told those parables, a lot of people didn't understand them.
Yeah.
So by most evangelist definitions, Jesus was not a good evangelist because didn't speak clearly. So, and, you know, these are some of the things that, as an artist, I have to deal with, because Christians are expecting this a movie as a sermon as a story, and that's not what it is. Story reaches deeper into the soul of a human than mere rationality or intellectual argumentation. Yes, the intellect and the mind is important for who we are and for connecting with truth, but it's not the only way and it's not the most important way. The Bible has imagination. God communicates truth through imagination. And that's what my other book, Word Pictures, Knowing God Through Stories and Imagination, is all about. It's about understanding that what art does, what a story can do, and visual art does this to different degrees as well, and music as well, but, you know, my thing is movies. What a story does is it connects to that imaginative part of us that can know truth, even apart from rationality. So this is why, you know, you can't, it's kind of mysterious sometimes, and it's, you can't box it in, and our modern day sort of stress on rationality and art and logic, it doesn't like that. We like to be able to pin everything down and put it in a box, and imagination frees you from a lot of that. And this is what C.S. Lewis realized when he got to that point in his life, you know, where he was, you know, he debated G.E. Anscombe, who was a Catholic, but they were debating about God, arguments for the existence of God, and Anscombe kind of demolished C.S. Lewis's arguments, and it really threw him for a loop. And what he realized was that he had been relying too much upon his reason and rationality to be sort of the foundation of his faith, and he realized there's so much more deeper than that, and reason is not the foundation of faith. Faith is the foundation of reason, and it was shortly after that that he got into writing Narnia and became more imagination-oriented because he realized the value of how imagination can connect to us in ways that reason can't. Hmm. And that's the power of storytelling. Think about it. Yeah, every time you watch that movie you love, you may not, you know, people may not, most of the time, look, people watch a movie and they just love the entertainment. But what they don't realize is that, and I assure you, I'm a writer, I'm in Hollywood, I work with movies. You know, if you read books on screenwriting, you'll discover that it's all about communicating a writer's worldview. We are persuading you, whether or not you realize it. And we do that by being able to embody that worldview. So you're watching a movie, you're getting entertained, guess what? If you're not aware of what the meaning of the movie is, that's okay. It's still going to affect you. In fact, it's going to affect you more because you're not thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So as those values seep through, you know, that's how it affects you. Now, the more that you can watch and be intelligently watch a movie, you know, then you're able to spot it and, you know, interact with it rationally and think about, well, this is what I like about it, this is what I don't like. So I think that there's a way to watch movies with discernment and be able to appreciate the good and, you know, and yet reject the bad. And the problem with too many Christians these days is, well, it's getting better. But, I mean, in past years, you know, Christians would, you know, tend to talk about how Hollywood is corrupting everyone and how movies twist and this is how they deceive you and this is how a movie manipulates you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that does happen. But guess what? That happens in books and that happens with everything. Because whenever unbelievers do something, they manipulate and twist. But that doesn't mean inherently that's what it does. And there's the good side of movies is that there are a lot of, I would argue, movies are a mixture of good and bad. There are a lot of bad values, but there are a lot of movies that have some good values, and some of those I think are good. I mean, I don't agree with everything in a movie, but I still think, like for instance, a movie out right now, The Conspirator, okay? It's the story of Mary Surratt and how she got tried for being a part of a conspiracy to kill Lincoln.
Right, right.
Well, the main message of that movie, you know, there's actually, Robert Redford did it, and he's a left-wing political activist in Hollywood, so you know everything he does kind of has that angle to it. And this movie is sort of his sort of analogy for, you know, I think some of the current dealings with terrorism that our country does. And yeah, whether or not you agree with that, whether or not you even think that connection is there is unimportant to me. But I think the movie has some real value in that it does address the issue of the Constitution and how valuable do we elevate the Constitution to protect our individual rights. Can you just take any citizen and just take them out and not give them a fair trial and put them into a military trial? I think these issues are very, very important, valuable conversation, and I think that's a good side of the movie. I don't agree with Robert Redford's politics, but in this movie, I agree with a lot of the things he's pointing out. That
mm-hmm.
is, we should not take individuals who are individual citizens and try them in military courts, who are individual citizens of America, that is. You know, we might disagree, we might have a good debate, but that's the whole point of movies, is they provide the fodder for good conversation. But that would be an example where I think, okay, I don't agree with all about the movie, but I think there's some good points in it that are valuable and that reinforce some of my values. So
we're talking with Brian Gadawa, author, screenwriter, director. His website, Gadawa.com, GODAWA.com, on A View from the Bunker. Now, I agree that reading books, watching film, a story that sucks you in will affect you, as you say, at a deeper level than at your top, the level of reason or what I think you might more accurately and bluntly call the BS filter. if that were not true, the Abbey in Scotland, which was featured in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, would not be hosting record numbers of visitors every year, people coming to search for the Holy Grail.
Yes. Yeah.
Which makes, you know, no sense unless you just go beyond logic and, you know, and allow yourself to be affected by the story that deeply that you feel compelled to go. So knowing that watching a film that's presenting a particular worldview may just sneak its worldview past our BS filters,
yes,
unless we're on guard. How do we watch film and television with wisdom and discernment, borrowing from the title of your book?
Very good question, and I hope I'm not too much of a rambler for you here tonight.
No, I think we're following a very logical thread here.
Okay, good. Yeah, excellent question. In my book, Hollywood Worldviews, what I do is I sort of reveal the tricks of the trade that we screenwriters use to write our stories. Basically, all art forms, including storytelling, have rules, right? Like if you were to go to a music appreciation class, they would teach you the rules about harmony, dissonance, mm-hmm, consonance, whatever. You know, I'm not a musician, but, you know, they would teach you different form, composition, so you would then be able to appreciate music more. Same thing with visual art, right? You understand composition and how color affects the eyes. Well, stories are the same way. And in my book, I explain to people some of the artistic story structural elements that need to be in a good story, because story is art too, and it follows rules. Now, the rules aren't absolute, but nonetheless, there's some general rules. And so I talk about those rules. And so, for example, a real brief, let me just, you know, run you through a real, really shotgun, you know, description is every good movie is basically going to have a main hero or the protagonist, right? And I'll just use the word hero because it's traditional, it's a good one. And that hero, you're going to see in the early part of the movie, that hero is sympathetic to us in one way or another, you know? And so we like him. So we want to go with him on his journey. So they make him likable, but they also give him a flaw. And that is, the way he looks at the world is basically good, but it's not quite right. And he also has this passionate desire for a goal. He wants something really bad. So within the first, you know, probably first third of the movie, you're going to see his normal world, what he's like, and then he's going to get a call, some kind of call to do something. And he's going to ultimately start on a quest for something that he wants really badly. And you got to have something he wants really badly. I mean, it could be justice. It could be this innocent person's been unjustly condemned, so I'm going to save him as a cop or as a lawyer or whatever. You know, you could have, I just want to marry this woman. You know, any kind of goal, but it's got to be something that makes the story interesting, because that's what makes us want to watch it. And that goal is obsessive. And then there's also a villain, and the villain basically wants the same goal, or wants to keep the hero from getting the goal. And so, you know, the middle of the movie is the hero trying to achieve this goal in some manner. I'm going to try to click on to a while I'm talking here. So they're pursuing that goal. In the middle of the movie is all these obstacles that keep the hero from wanting to achieve the goal. And consequently, the obstacles build to the point where it looks like they're never going to achieve that goal. They're never going to achieve what they really want. And it brings them against the wall, and they have the dark night of the soul. They realize, what I wanted all along is not what I want. What I really need, is this, fix this internal flaw that's wrong with the way I see the world. When they make that change, they're able to have the outer strength to overcome the villain. And they have the ultimate battle at the end with the villain. And it could be, you know, in an action movie, it's a physical battle, but in a drama, it might be, you know, a different kind of battle, you know. It might be more of a personal thing, or if you've got a romantic comedy, it's, you know, you the other guy who wants the girl is battling for her, and you win over him. But the point is you achieve that. You either give up the goal because you realize something else is more important, and then you end up getting the goal as a result of giving it up, and then you have the denouement, which is life after the hero, you know, learns what they needed to learn, changes the way they see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what life is like after that. And basically, you know, that's the story of redemption. That's why storytelling is really about redemption. And as you cheer, as you root for the hero, you are actually entering into their story. Because you like them, you're cheering them on, you're rooting them. So it's like you're following the argument. The hero is the worldview that the storytellers want you to ultimately, you know, live and see the world by. And as the hero realizes what's wrong with the way he sees the world and has to make an adjustment, so you will be carried along with his decisions and realize with him. And then at the end, you know, you're going to see the world differently, and you're going to sort of, yeah, you know, that's true, and I like that. And the hero, this is how the hero sort of saw the world at the end. And like I said, it may not be a conscious thing that you do, but by rooting for the hero, you are. It's like a person is giving you an argument, and you're entering into the argument, and you're agreeing with it. Okay, take me along in this argument. Okay, and then A follows B, follows C. Okay, well, that's like the hero going on his journey, following the obstacles, and then when he overcomes each obstacle in the story, you know, that's like saying, you know, I'm answering the objections to your philosophical argument, right? And then by the end of the story, the hero realizes he has to adjust, and then you adjust with him. And so that's how you've been persuaded. Hmm.
You know, a couple of our favorite movies, and I don't know how big an adjustment it requires of the viewing audience, certainly not as much for people who've been persuaded by the Gnostic leanings of Dan Brown, but a couple of our favorite movies that follow exactly the formula you laid out are Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes.
Where there's a literal salvation moment where yeah. George Clooney's character hits his knees just before the cleansing waters of the flood.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, symbolism, wash away his sins and they're redeemed. And the movie Signs with Mel Gibson.
Yes.
Where he literally has that long dark night in the basement where they're hiding from the aliens / demons who are searching for them in the house above. And he comes to realize that his son's relationship to him is very much like the relationship he's got with God, and that adjusting that relationship, the way he views his relationship with God and God's reasons for doing things, changes the way he sees the entire world.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to add, I love Signs as well, and I think Signs is a great example of a movie that understands faith, and the notion is, you know, Mel Gibson is actually an ex-pastor, a priest or whatever, Episcopal priest, so he's mm-hmm. given up his faith because of his wife dying, which is a very common thing, and actually I feel quite understandable. You know, his wife gets killed in an accident, and he loses his faith because, what, you know, how could a loving God do this?
Right.
But ultimately, through his little boy having asthma, which is another element of suffering, why is my son have asthma? But God uses all these things providentially in their lives to protect them from the alien at the end,
mm-hmm.
such that he realizes real faith is not trying to control, but letting go and allowing God to control your life, not you being in control of your life. And so, and that's a lesson that I think everyone does have to learn, that mm-hmm. faith is, you know, we want faith to be something that we could control. Okay, I'll believe God if it fits the way I think he should be, you know, but you soon learn that God is bigger than you, and the whole essence of knowing God is to be able to give in to him
mm-hmm.
and allow him to, even though you don't understand everything that happens to you in life, allowing yourself to be given over. So that journey from unbelief in the beginning of the movie, right, to belief at the end, that's the character arc, what we call the character arc. But think about it. That's also persuasion. The man who thinks one way, how could there be a loving God, all this suffering, I really have trouble with it, to at the end, okay, God, you're right, I'm wrong, you know more than I do. And I accept the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're all trying to communicate to everybody, isn't it? Well, that movie shows you better than any argument I can try to make to people. It shows you, oh, here's how it all kind of works, you know?
Right.
Here's how it works.
And there are some symbols in that film. As my wife and I have gone back and watched that movie probably a dozen times or more, that become more and more obvious every time we watch it. I am almost amazed that M. Night Shyamalan got that movie through Hollywood. I mean, the elements that defeated the aliens at the end were water, baptism, and wood, the baseball bat, you know, the wood of the cross. And as if to reemphasize the point in the final scene where Mel Gibson is putting his collar back on, he closes the door, which is a paneled wooden door, but with a very unique design on the panel. The panel is itself a cross.
Yeah.
It's not a standard six-panel door that you see in, you know, every subdivision in America today. It's a cross on the door. Like, whoa, how did I miss that the first time I watched the movie?
Yeah, I love it. Plus, I didn't even think of the whole water connection. You're right. It's like the water and baptism, and that's great.
So, yeah, it is a wonderful example of how ideas can be conveyed through story and through imagination, again, borrowing from the title of your book, Word Pictures. Now, what are some of the ideas that you're trying to convey? Maybe, you know, what are some of the things, the projects that you're working on now and that you might be able to tease ahead? What sort of ideas might we see coming from the mind of Brian Gadawa in the near future?
Yeah. Well, I'm still trying to get funding for Cruel Logic. So if there's any rich people out there who want to fund a movie, get a hold of me. but truthfully, too, there's a lot of things. You mentioned the movie Alleged, which hopefully is coming out later this year. Independent film, low budget, but it's coming out, and it's
strong
about
cast though.
Trial. What's that?
Strong cast though. Fred Dalton and Brian Dennehy are among two of my favorite actors.
Yes. Yes. And you know, that is a movie that deals with the Scopes Monkey Trial, which is a very famous thing that set the stage for America and the way that America deals with creation evolution debate. And we rather than making a movie that's the opposite of Inherit the Wind, we wanted to sort of address some of the things that most people know about that trial is not true, because they base it on that movie Inherit the Wind, and Inherit the Wind was a total caricature that even evolutionists will admit that it's just not true to the facts, and things didn't happen necessarily the way they depicted them. But also, I'm working on several other things. I've got a horror film called Descent of the Gods, and that's one that we're close to getting funding, and I'll be directing that. And that's a story that's kind of like it's a found footage film, which is kind of like Blair Witch Project or the most recent one, The Last Exorcism, where the premise of the story is the movie that you're seeing is the found footage that someone finds at a scene of a crime that people were shooting the film footage before everyone got killed. And so you're finding out what happened.
Okay.
And that one is a story of a reality TV crew who goes up to a remote mountain cabin to debunk UFO sightings and alien abductions, and they soon discover they're dead wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And some wild things start to happen, and I can't give away what happens, but it's a fun ride, and we're hoping to be shooting that soon. But, you know, it takes a while before that stuff gets completed and gets released.
You know, there was a movie that came out in 2009 that we watched on recommendation, starred Cuba Gooding Jr., called The Devil's Tomb, which was very disappointing because it was one of the few films. It was released by Sony, directed by Sean Connery's son. And, you know, Cuba Gooding Jr. is an excellent actor. It actually depicted guys going into a bunker in Iraq, which I think is significant. And they discover what they believe to be a demon who's been trapped in this underground bunker. But it looks like an alien gray. But from there. But from there, the movie just gets ridiculous, and it's stupid, and it was sad because it was the first time I thought we were going to see a major motion picture that depicted the alien fallen angel agenda. Is that something that you're going to touch on?
Believe me, there are many Nephilim movies that have gone around Hollywood. People trying to get movies made about the Nephilim, and right now I've written a script about Noah and the Nephilim, and I'm actually finishing up adapting it to a novel, because I'm also just going to get it as a novel out there, because it's really hard to get this is like a $150 million movie. It's like Avatar, and my personal interest, I've been very deeply affected by Michael Heiser, who I know he's been on your show a few times, and his writings about the Nephilim and the Divine Council and such, and I've been so affected by him that I've written this story about Noah, and I based it. It's really not like your Sunday school Noah's Ark, okay? This isn't Noah with the old man and the beard building it. I basically focused on all the stuff that led up to the destruction of the world, and it ends with the flood. But really, it deals with that weirdest of Bible passages. Genesis 6, verse 1 through 4, and the sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful, and they had intercourse with them, and they were Nephilim, and they bore them giants. And so I wrote a movie, and I'm finishing up the novel about that. And it's very imaginative. It's a lot of creative license. It's very fantasy. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings. But it's interesting because I found out that there are, all around town, there are Bible movies being developed at the studios. There are a couple Exodus movies being developed. There are a couple King David movies. I mentioned Scott Derrickson, who's working on Goliath, which is you know, your listeners might be interested to hear this. I know Scott, and so I gave him some feedback on the script, and the script is very kind of imaginative. It doesn't take much from the Bible, but it's not like it's contradictory. It's just it decided to take what might have happened before David met Goliath, and it's kind of like the Terminator in what is it? 7th century BC. Whenever David was around. Sorry, I don't know that time period. Goliath has been hired by the Philistines to hunt him down as an assassin, and so it's just a chase movie, which is a brilliant idea. A lot of Christians probably won't like it, but it does end with the famous confrontation of David and Goliath, and David does win and all that. But I actually gave Scott some feedback on explaining to him how that there's a whole theology of Nephilim, as you and your listeners know, and.
Mm-hmm.
And I explained to him how, well, you know, Goliath is an Anakim, and the Anakim are descendants of Nephilim, and guess what? That goes back to before Noah. And so I explained to him sort of there's a theological connection behind Goliath as the seed of the serpent at war with the seed of the woman, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I don't know if he's going to put it into the story, but I told him about that, and we'll see what happens. But that's kind of fun and exciting, you know.
It is interesting to see that there are some stories that are making their way through the pipeline in Hollywood. How much should we as Christians expect the message to remain true to Scripture, or does it depend on which who's producing it, and who's distributing it?
It depends entirely on who's making the movie. Writers, producers, and directors are the key. Content influencers, unfortunately, the ultimate content influencer is the studio, and they oftentimes take movies away from the creatives and distort it and twist it. And I have to say there is bigotry in Hollywood against Christians.
Hmm.
And they've taken away projects that were, you know, that have had Christian worldview in them, like John Milton's Paradise Lost. That's been one that's being developed and stuff. That does happen, but I'm not going to say it's absolute because there are people who still get through or maintain, and they are kind of aware of the fact that you can't change the Bible too much because people will hate you because they know they have some belief. But they have some appreciation of the fact that Christians really revere the Bible, so if they change it too much, they'll hate them. But I still think Christians have to become a little bit more open-minded in their appreciation of imagination and stories, and allow a little bit of freedom because, you know, let's face it, if you try to translate some Bible stories directly to the screen, it's not going to work. It's not going to be a movie that's going to make a lot of money and people are going to want to go see it. So you have to make sometimes alterations to the stories to make it work better, and Christians have to have a little bit more grace in that area. It's not always done just to distort the Bible. Sometimes it's done to make it work better as a movie, and they have to be a little bit more gracious in that area, I think.
Is there an example that you can think of off the top of your head?
Well, yeah, this Goliath one, I'll tell you that right now, because the fact of the matter is I want to see it, man. It's cool. It's like, you know, a Terminator, but in 7th century BC, Israel, The director is a Christian, and he's going to try to stay true. The goal is to stay true to the spiritual theme and message of the Bible while having some fun with the other parts of it. And, you know, by the way, that's really not that different from what the Hebrews themselves did during the entire Second Temple period of Israel, where if you look at a lot of books in the Pseudepigrapha, you know, Jubilees, Enoch, there's a lot of books of Adam and Eve, Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. There's a lot of non-biblical literature that Jews wrote, and what it was they kind of rewrote Bible stories, but they amplified them, and they sort of extrapolated them in a way. They're retelling the stories to sort of be relevant to their current situation. So they try to remain true to the theology of the story, but they were also kind of retelling them, you know, for their own audiences and such. And that, you know, okay, they're not scripture, but you can at least appreciate that they're trying to remain true to the spirit of and the message without, you know, these specific little details will not always work. You know, so.
Well, and besides which, as regards Goliath, there's not really a whole lot of information in the Bible about Goliath. If you just stick to the actual story that's depicted there, you're going to have a very, very short film.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And the idea here is that, look, everybody knows the Goliath story, but let's tell from a new angle. That's another. We always want to tell a story from a new angle to kind of bring new interest to it. And, you know, like I said, Scott wants to stay true to the end, which David becomes king and overcomes Goliath in that battle with just his rock and his sling. So that's all there. But what if, you know, Goliath had a background that was more connected to David and he was, you know, and let's get to that conclusion from a unique, fresh angle to appreciate the story from a new angle. That's the best I can say.
No,
So I would want Christians to be a little bit more open-minded, but also, let's face it, it's true. There's a lot of these stories. I heard another one about creation and Genesis or something was being developed at Fox Studios, and there was a Christian at the helm, the director and stuff, and after a couple of years, he ended up having to back out because they were just ruining it. Hmm. So it does, you know, unfortunately it does happen where studios will ruin this. But, you know, if more and more Christians will get the vision to make movies, and the more of us get involved in Hollywood, and as we climb the ladder and get in positions of not just writing, producing, directing, but executives and at all the different levels, we can have more of a general influence just like they have, you know? I mean, if you look at various interest groups in Hollywood, you know, the gays did this, where they got deeply involved into Hollywood and in key positions of power, so that now, you know, they have a lot of influence on the content of movies because they're policing and they're doing all kinds of stuff because they're in positions of power. And so then that's why you see a lot more of their agenda in movies. And I'm not saying we got to go in there and take over Hollywood, but what I am saying is if we get more of us get involved, more of a general, better influence we'll have, just like in any field, in any world. You know, if there's a town of 10,000 people with 100 Christians versus the town with 10,000 people and 5,000 Christians, don't you think the 5,000 Christians involved in that other city is going to be a little bit better, more effect for your values than the one with only 100? So let's stop condemning Hollywood and damning it for the bad stuff, but let's send our missionaries, our kids as missionaries into that field to try to make movies that reflect their values. And it's a hard, I think, like we're still at the beginnings of that transformation, but it is occurring, and it's very hard, and a lot of us get stomped on at the front lines.
Yep.
But there are things that are getting through, I think. And we just have to keep the vision up and build the vision into the youth, the next generation.
We're talking with Brian Godawa on A View from the Bunker. His website is godawa.com, G-O-D-A-W-A. One final question. We kind of bring it full circle to the theme and the reference to your short film, Cruel Logic, that started all this. The idea, the theme, the message that ideas have consequences. When people see Cruel Logic, either the short film or, you know, if it should become a feature film someday, what is the takeaway that you hope people leave the theater or leave their computer screen with after watching it?
Well, I would say it's not, I don't know how ambitious it will be, but ambitious that the takeaway is, but I want them to be able to walk away and think more about the way they see the world and realize for themselves that what are the beliefs that I have that I'm not thinking through, that I need to think through. And quite frankly, I also want them to consider God, because the movie ultimately does deal with God, because after all, it's a movie that is about a serial killer and people are facing their death, and the issue of God comes up. It's not about preaching, but it is about, if you're going to face death, you're going to have to deal with it. Is there a God who exists or not? If there's morality, is there God? So they honestly deal with the arguments for the existence of God in there. And I want people to consider that reality. I want them to look at morality and say, you know what? If there is no morality, or first of all, if there is morality, there has to be a God, because there has to be some ultimate rule giver. But if I don't believe there is morality, then I have to realize that I have no moral authority to condemn evil. There is no such thing as evil, which I don't, you know, I want people to realize that's foolishness. That's foolishness. And so I want them to think about the way they see the world, about ethics and about the existence of God. But, you know, it's not that I want to convert them into becoming, you know, my belief system. I want to challenge them about certain key things that are embedded within that story.
Mm. And once you do, as I have had some discussions with friends of mine with contrary belief systems, that if you start with the premise that there is no external source or ultimate arbiter of right and wrong,
yes,
then every man is free to do what's right in his own eyes.
Yes, which they certainly would not want that if they really had it.
Exactly right. Brian Gadawa, author, writer, director, website gadawa.com. I'll put a link in the show notes at vftb.net, not only to the website, but also to where you can see the short film, Cruel Logic, and encourage you to check out the links at his site to his future projects, his other writings. And Brian, this has been a fascinating conversation. We've only scratched the surface of the topic. We'd love to have you back again just to comment on the culture, what we're seeing from the media, and how it affects us as Christians.
You bet, Derek.
See the show notes at vftb.net. That's View from the Bunker, vftb.net, for links to Brian Gadawa's website and to the short film Cruel Logic, which is well worth the 6 minutes it'll take to watch it. Disturbing, thought-provoking, and drives home the point that ideas have consequences, not just in this life, but as Christians, we understand those consequences extend into the next one as well. Those ideas, or some ideas and their consequences, will be the focus of the future Congress on Emerging Threats and Challenges 2011. That's July 22nd through the 24th in Branson, Missouri. Now, this conference is being organized by Tom and Nita Horn, and we invite you to attend because it is a world-class lineup of speakers and workshop presenters, and Sharon and I are honored to be a part of this. Some of the speakers include Dr. Chuck Missler, G. Edward Griffin, Gary Stearman, of course, Tom and Nita Horn, documentary filmmaker Chris Pinto, our good friends Dr. Future and Tom Bionic, Dr. Michael Bennett and Mike Tater Jr., of course, my better and more intelligent half, Sharon, will be speaking as well. Ray Gano, Jim Fletcher, Rob Skiba, filmmaker, Keith Robinson, author, others, Terry James, just a wide range of viewpoints and perspectives on things that affect us and the ideas and their consequences that affect us in this time-space continuum. And boy, it is something that we really look forward to. We are planning to record interviews with as many of these folks as we can grab to sit down with us. Our good friend Sam Miller and his lovely wife Alice are going to help with the videotaping of this event. There's a possibility that we may get some overseas coverage as well. We're talking with the folks in the UK about the possibility of conducting some interviews for distribution and rebroadcast in England. So this is a very exciting event. Again, we're just honored to be a part of this, and you'll find all the information about it at futurecongress.com. That's futurecongress.com, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Until next time, remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.